Congress is in the middle of a budget debate, and a big part of that debate is the budget plan already passed with the votes of Republicans in the House of Representatives. The proposal envisions major changes to both the Medicare and Medicaid health programs. So we've asked NPR's Julie Robner to look at how the changes might work if they were passed into law. She begins with Medicare.
The heart of the House budget plan for Medicare is to give everybody a pot of money every year instead of the government-run health insurance they get now. Well, it's not really a pot of money. It's actually a subsidy they could only use to buy private health insurance. Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, who wrote the plan, says it would make Medicare just like the health insurance he gets as a member of Congress. He even read from the Federal Worker Health Insurance Handbook during the budget debate.
Look at all these plans we get to choose from. Kaiser, Aetna, Humana, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Coventry, pages and pages of choices and options. This is what we're talking about.
It's not at all what you'll have.
Austin Fracht is a health economist at Boston University. He says one key advantage of the health plans available to members of Congress is that the subsidies they get to pay for their health insurance premiums keep up with rising health care costs.
The government keeps paying a proportion of the premium that's not necessarily identical to what it is today, but it keeps pace. It doesn't erode over time.
But that's not how Congressman Ryan's Medicare proposal is designed. Under his plan, the amount you'd get to buy insurance would only go up as fast as inflation in the rest of the economy. And Fracht says that could be a big problem. Health costs tend to rise much faster, sometimes twice as fast, as overall inflation.
So that difference means that the subsidy is kind of riding along, going up at a very slow rate, and healthcare costs are going way up, and premiums reflect healthcare costs. So that entire difference is shifted to beneficiaries.
In other words, Ryan's plan allows the government to spend less on Medicare by making patients pay more, potentially a lot more. In fact, says Fracht, eventually Medicare patients might be paying so much and the government contributing so little that Medicare, which provides basic health coverage to virtually all of America's seniors, will be little more than a memory.
Over time, the involvement of Medicare in paying for healthcare costs is a smaller and smaller share. Beneficiaries are paying more and more. And basically, Medicare is just phased out. It's gone.
That's a pretty dramatic statement, but Democrats are in basic agreement that Congressman Ryan's plan would essentially end Medicare in its current form and shift healthcare costs to seniors and the disabled. And they don't like the idea. Here's President Obama at a town hall meeting in Virginia.
I mean, it's not hard to save the government money if you're willing to just say, here, you pay for it. That's not a solution.
Still, Congressman Ryan and his supporters say their plan doesn't just shift costs, that there are elements that actually would reduce health care spending. For example, Michael Cannon of the Libertarian Cato Institute says having people spend their own money rather than the government's helps.
They'll be cost-conscious consumers. They'll choose economical health plans. They'll put downward pressure on prices because they will get to see the savings.
At the same time, Cannon says, more competition within the healthcare industry can also hold down prices.
Because in order to capture the business of those cost-conscious consumers, health plans, providers will have to find ways to cut costs while improving quality.
So far, the Ryan plan is barely more than an outline, and it's going nowhere in the Democratic-led Senate. But it's an important marker in the emerging Medicare debate. And that debate comes with more than a few political perils. Medicare clearly needs some kind of fix to withstand the onslaught of 78 million baby boomers. But so far, public opinion polls show that neither Republican nor Democratic voters favor any big changes to the program. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Let's hear another entry now in the debate over how to reduce poverty around the world. That debate often divides on ideological lines. People more to the left want more foreign aid. People more to the right argue it's often counterproductive. Two authors argue that this whole debate often misses the point. Their book is called Poor Economics, and they say that many people spin out their views without considering the behavior of the real people they say they want to help. Co-author Abhijit Banerjee says many people donate to developing countries based on false ideas.
One that's very influential is the idea that the poor are starving, I think, and that the primary focus of development policy should be to provide them food. That's one that numerous programs are motivated by that idea. And I think the evidence is that the poor don't act as if they're starving. They seem to be willing to trade off, you know, a little less food for an opportunity to buy a television or something.
An opportunity to buy a television?
Yep.
People will go hungry to buy a television?
I don't know that they go hungry. I think we are assuming they're going hungry because we think that somehow they're poor, so they must be eating too little. I'm not sure they are hungry. I think hunger is a social construct, so I'm not sure, you know, it might be that they are not eating as much as they should. But the study after study after study finds that when people get slightly richer, they are looking for pleasure as well as nutrition, even at the lowest levels of income. You know, if you give them some extra money, they don't go and buy more nutrition. They buy more tasty foods, like we would. I mean, they want to live a life. They don't want to just invest in their future or something.
So your view is that if a poor kid gets a nickel or the equivalent of a nickel, even if he is not well fed, he may go straight to the candy counter because that's something special.
Yes.
And so?
And that's so would I, probably. I think one thing that would be extremely useful to do is to think of ways to get poor people, and especially poor children, to get a lot more micronutrients.
Micronutrients means what? That's vitamins and so forth?
Vitamins, iron, calcium, all kinds of things like that. And so, that's where the deficit is. The real, clear, established deficit is there. You know, an example we often give is candy that has micronutrients in it. Make that cheap, make it available in all schools. Children love candy. They'll get lots of nutrients from it.
And so you want to just basically think in a little more nuanced way about human behavior and how to work with it rather than unconsciously working against it.
Yes.
Do you think that most of the billions of dollars that people in the West send to Africa or Asia are misspent?
I have no idea, to be honest. But I'm less worried about money down the drain as such, but whether you could sharpen the effect, could you make it work just much better?
Abhijit Banerjee is co-author of Poor Economics, which he wrote with Esther DeFlo. Both are economics professors at MIT.
The U.S. government has passed laws that make drug dealers rich and increase violence on the streets. That's according to several prominent economics papers on the impact of making drugs, including cocaine and heroin, illegal. Planet Money's Alex Bloomberg reviewed these papers, then ran their conclusions by another expert, an actual drug dealer.
The academic argument against drug criminalization goes like this. When you make something illegal, you make it harder and riskier to produce, and that makes it more expensive. You have to sneak it across the border. You have to pay people more to transport it since they're facing jail time. So illegal drugs are much more expensive than they would be if they were legal. But, and here's the key, demand for a lot of drugs is what economists call inelastic. No matter what the drugs cost, people will still pay for them. So making drugs more expensive by criminalization just sends more money to drug dealers. That's the theory anyway.
My name is Ricky Ross. I'm known on the streets as Freeway Rick. Well, when I sold drugs, if they'd have told me they was going to legalize it, I'd have been mad because I knew that that was going to drive the price down.
Freeway Rick Ross was one of L.A.'s biggest crack dealers in the 80s and 90s. He was arrested in 1996, given a life sentence, but paroled in 2009. So he's a perfect reality check for these academic theories. And I started him off with claim number one, making drugs illegal drives up the price. Check.
The most I ever made in one day was $3 million went through my hands. Out of that $3 million, I could make off of $1 million, I could make anywhere from $400,000 to $200,000 profit.
Next up, claim number two. At least some of the money Ross was getting wound up in the hands of criminals. Again, check.
I had a crew. You know, I had guys around me that were ruthless and were tough. You know, if I gave a word, they would hurt you.
And Ross's money wasn't just going to his own crew. He'd also distribute cash to other big players around the neighborhood.
You know, I had a fund where I take care of what's called the big homies, the shot callers, the guys that ran the neighborhood. As you know, they kidnap drug dealers in South Central.
It's sort of like you were paying protection money to these people, right?
Absolutely. You can call it protection money or big homie money or whatever, but it's all the same thing. They were robbers. They was killers, jackers, as we call them. Absolutely.
These days, Ross runs an organization that he says is trying to undo all the harm he did to his community by selling crack. Says a big part of the reason he got into drug dealing in the first place, he was illiterate. That's right, he ran a multi-million-dollar drug business for years without knowing how to read. He finally learned in prison. And talking to Ross, you realize there was this other incentive that doesn't always show up in the economics literature. At least when you get to Ross's level, drug dealing is not only lucrative, it's complex and engaging. Ross was a CEO, he was a manager, his own publicist, an accountant. Society had done everything it could to make Rick Ross hate his job and give up. His product was illegal, his costs were enormous, he was a hunted man. And yet...
I loved it. I felt like I was on top of the world, I felt I was powerful. I felt I'd came, I didn't have to answer to nobody. I mean, it was a dream. It was every man's dream to be free.
How much of it was just sort of like the actual job, and how much of it was just the feeling of being good at something and running this enterprise well?
Do you think? You love the feeling of that you're good. So it didn't feel like it was a burden, you know, to sneak around at night. I've been sneaking around at night since I was 17 years old, stealing cars. You know, we've been hiding all our life.
So does all this mean we should legalize drugs like crack and heroin? If we really wanted to make the freeway Rick Rosses of the world miserable, we'd take away their earning potential, right? And some of the economists I spoke to said, yeah, make them legal. Other economists weren't so sure. Economist Peter Reuter has written many, many pages on the topic of drug criminalization. And he says, if you legalize drugs, sure, crime would go down. But drug use, that'd go up.
How do we compare the bad outcomes in the two cases? A very large increase in addiction with a very large decrease in crime. I take them both to be real, but I don't know how. That's a value judgment.
How do you, which is better?
As to which is better, right.
As for Freeway Rick Ross, his basic take, and a lot of academics agree with him, you need to attack the demand side. Try and reduce the reasons people want to use drugs in the first place. I'm Alex Blumberg for NPR News.
NPR's business news starts with General Motors still on track. GM's profit tripled in the first quarter compared to the same period last year. It's the company's highest quarterly profit in more than a decade. CEO Dan Akerson calls it solid. Despite rising gas prices, the company saw its vehicle sales jump about 25% this year, in part because of the popularity of its smaller vehicles like the Chevy Cruze. Although GM also announced today that it is recalling more than 150,000 Cruzes to check that the steering shafts were properly installed.